pieces on our oral argument schedule for this afternoon, beginning with People versus Collett. Council are set up and ready to go on that one. And then after that, we have, I guess we have four cases. Then we have Statman versus University of Colorado at Boulder. Anyone here on that one yet?
Council for the University of Colorado, Your Honor, but my opposing counsel, I haven't seen yet.
Okay. Thank you. Counsel on the present case before us, People versus Collett, have you had a chance to review the procedural instructions? You get a copy on your counsel table there, and are you familiar with those? Okay, if you need any questions answered regarding any of those procedures. Okay. In addition to that, I will remind everyone in the audience, if you have a pager or a cell phone or any other kind of device that might go off during the proceedings, please make sure you turn those off so counsel and the court are not interrupted. So at this time, if there are no other questions from counsel to begin with, we will call the case of People versus Collett, Brian Collett, 08CA0398.
Your Honors, my name is Michael Williams, and I'm ADC counsel for Mr. Collett on this matter. My registration number is 31120. Your Honor, I do realize that you've read the briefs, and at least one of you have read the record per the handout that I've received. But I would like to outline a little bit of some of our complaints, if you will, with the trial court. We do believe that defense counsel's representation at the trial level fell outside the wide range of professionally competent assistance, which is usually demanded of defense counsel in criminal cases under prevailing professional norms. That's P versus Garcia, 815 P second, 937, it's also cited in my brief. Your Honors, it is uncontested that defense counsel admitted on the stand and even through cross-examination that basically he did fail to get the discovery, 50 pages of which for an F3 burglary, a complex case, until the date and the time of the providency hearing when he realized that he did not have the discovery, walked over to the district attorney and asked to see it. We can only assume that he got everything, but I do know as a trial attorney that I file a lot of motions for more discovery per Rule 16 because things are missing. Therein, he went to meet with Mr. Collett right there in the courtroom to start reviewing the 50 pages of discovery. He negotiated and already received an offer with the district attorney prior to receiving the discovery. So it begs the question, what position was he in to be able to adequately discuss this case both with his client at the jail 2 months prior to, as well as with the district attorney for ongoing negotiations to be able to get the most effective plea bargaining that he could? And his justification that he testified to at the 35C hearing was that this was not an issue to get the discovery because the defendant was going to plead guilty to the charge. We don't know how, again, trial counsel could have spoken intelligently with Mr. Collett about whether he's going to plead guilty to the charge and the possible defenses, et cetera. So we get to, again, the 50 pages of discovery. Even if he's reviewing these pages 1 minute at a time, we're looking at 50 minutes, plus trial counsel is trying to review the Rule 11 plea paperwork that is standard in Will County on the other four cases. Regarding the date discrepancy comes up as well. So Mr. Collett asks his trial attorney to go tell the district attorney, I'm not pleading to this, I'm not guilty of this. Trial counsel comes back and says this is what the deal is.
Where was the date discrepancy in the discovery?
Your Honor, that is frankly somewhat of a mystery. I have been provided the discovery that I have. I cannot locate the date discrepancy. But clearly there was a date discrepancy because it came up not just, I know that the Honorable Judge Hartman discusses that coming up in the PSI as a typographical error, but clearly it came up at the providency hearing, or the dispositional hearing, because that's what erupted, if you will, this entire issue, Your Honor, is that Mr. Collette noted a date discrepancy, told his attorney that, hey, I was in custody in Wyoming on that date, so I couldn't have committed this crime, Your Honor. And that's, again, we keep on going forward from there.
Well, let's pause on that for a minute. So at the plea inquiry where the defendant pled to the offense occurring on March 2, was there any discussion of a discrepancy that he was incarcerated in Wyoming on March 2?
With his trial counsel at the providency hearing? I believe there was, yes. That's what triggered him to say, I was in custody this time. Go tell the DA I'm not pleading guilty to this case.
I thought he said he was in custody beginning on March 12.
Your Honor, that is what the factual issue is, as far as whether or not to go to trial, which I know gets into prejudice, but that's up to the jury to decide whether or not.
Wait a minute, Mr. Williams, I'm not understanding you, or you're not understanding me.
Okay.
As I understand it, the date of the offense as charged is March 2. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor. I'm writing this down.
And the defendant pled guilty to March 2. Now, did defendant say that date is wrong? I could not have committed that offense on March 2.
Your Honor, I believe what the argument is that he noted the date discrepancy of the March 20th, said that he was incarcerated as of March 12th, and that he could not have been guilty of the March 20th date if that was the proper date, Your Honor.
But that was not the date on the charge, was it?
That was not the date on the information, no, Your Honor.
And and on that date, he did not say, I was not available on March 2.
Correct. He's saying that he was not available on March 20th.
Which was not the date of the offense.
As listed in the information, correct, Your Honor.
It was only after the PSIR came out, and the PSIR originally said, erroneously said March 20, that he challenged the PSIR.
Your Honor, that's not correct factually, because he challenged that date. He noticed a date discrepancy somewhere in the discovery at the providency hearing before the PSR was ever drafted or completed, or that he interviewed with probation department.
So he did see the date in the discovery, but you've not been able to find it.
Correct, Your Honor.
Thank you. And is that in the record that he brought that up? Is that, can we find that in the transcript?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that you can.
Okay.
And to continue, Your Honors, noting this entire issue that's going on in the courtroom, trial counsel testified that it was a complex case. He had multiple cases, probation cases. Trial counsel, I discussed aggravated sentences, concurrent, consecutive sentencing, and the defense counsel testified at the 35th hearing that it was a little bit difficult to explain to the defendant exactly how all of this works, which includes, of course, this whole issue with the alibi, possible defense, and the discovery issues and everything else. Then we stack on another level, Your Honor, which is the competency evaluation. Trial counsel did have Mr. Collette evaluated for his competency to even proceed to trial, so counsel was on notice that Mr. Collette was not, frankly, the sharpest tool in the toolbox, that he did have low self-esteem, he was not assertive, and he had difficult coping with stress. So we're dealing with all of these issues that trial counsel was aware of. And again, he said on the stand, defense counsel, no, that's not the way that I would have liked, you know, to have done it. Conceding that reviewing 50 pages of an F3 burglary discovery with a client in the courtroom during a short break is probably not the best practice. And the trial court agreed by stating this court wouldn't recommend that discovery be reviewed with the defendant just prior to the defendant walking up to the podium and accepting the plea in the felony case. And then Judge Hartman took it in a different direction.
Excuse me, counsel.
Yes, Your Honor.
Other than the discrepancy in the date that Judge Carparelli just asked about, were there any other allegations by Mr. Collette of deficiencies in trial counsel's performance
that he was advised incorrectly by counsel about defenses, or that there was anything else other than the date discrepancy as a basis for his claim of ineffective assistance.
Sorry, I should have blessed you. I apologize. Your Honor, yes, Mr. Collette did bring up the issue that he thought that he was going to receive 14 years sentence. He was sentenced to 14 years on this case, but he thought that was going to be the total sentence, not 24 years. So he did have an objection with, to answer your question, yes, he did complain of trial counsel's advisement for the total maximum possible penalty under the plea agreement that he's going to receive, which again, he thought was going to be 14 years, not 24 years. So, Your Honors, to conclude with, I guess, the performance prong, Mr. Collette clearly had some reservations about pleading guilty in this case, and noting the totality of everything that I just outlined, is our position that the counsel failed to render reasonable effective assistance to counsel for the performance prong. As far as the prejudice prong, Your Honors, akin to either a motion for summary judgment or to a jury instruction for self-defense, there's obviously a factual dispute. Judge Hartman says that that Mr. Collette was not very credible, and that no attorney would put his reputation on the line to bring this kind of alibi defense to the jury. Frankly, Your Honor, as an ADC attorney, I don't always like the facts that I have, but they're what I have. And if the jury would have believed that Mr. Collette was incarcerated on March 12th throughout, and that the date of the offense happened on March 20th and not on March 2nd, he would have been found not guilty or acquitted, Your Honors. And I believe that that is strong prejudice from that standpoint.
What evidence was there that the jury could have believed, which would have led them to conclude the offense occurred on March 20th?
Obviously, Your Honor, the officer would have had to testify and been subpoenaed through the defense, through the trial, and through cross-examination, where did this date come from? And as well as...
Where did which date come from?
Where did the March 20th date, where did any of the dates come from, but specifically, I guess, the March 20th date?
But where did it come from on what document? What document are you talking about? I mean, the PSIR is not there yet. PSIR is not going to be there for the trial. So you're saying that he's going to be cross-examined, the police officer is going to be cross-examined as to where this date came from. Can you point us to anywhere in the record that March 20th date appears, such that he could have been so cross-examined?
No, Your Honor, and I guess I shouldn't tie my hands so much. The discussion with Mr. Manzer could have also discussed I was in custody on this case, and whether it's March 2nd or whether it's March 12th or March 20th, it's still up to it's still a question of fact for the jury, Your Honor, to decide whether or not Mr. Collette had an alibi, whether or not he was guilty of all of the elements for the F3 burglary for which he was charged. And by stating that he was not guilty and that he had a defense, of course, including an alibi defense, that was an argument that a defense attorney could have, of course, argued to the jury and have the jury concluded that Mr. Collette had an alibi or that he was not guilty of the offense, regardless of the dates, and if he would have been found not guilty. He had brought this up to trial counsel on the date of the Providency hearing, and it went forward, Your Honor. One question is, of course, why did Mr. Collette go forward that day? I think that falls back on to some of the issues in the competency evaluation. He's not very assertive. All this stuff is happening very fast. He's told by his defense attorney that this is the deal, kind of take it or leave it type of an issue.
Let me interrupt you for a minute. What do we do with the trial court's finding of fact? The trial court has said that your client was not credible when he said that he would have not pled guilty. And of course, the standard of review on that's basically clearly erroneous. And are you expecting us to conclude that the trial court's finding is clearly erroneous?
Well, Your Honor, two parts to that. I think that there is some credibility issues for Mr. Collette, because since he was dealing with 8 total cases and he's only complaining about this case, I think that does show some credibility. He's not, we don't have, you know, 835 C's before your honors, we have one. So I think that there is some credible issues that he's standing behind his convictions in those matters. And sorry, your honors, I just lost my train of thought for what I was going to say for part two.
As far as our standard of review on the trial court's findings, are we stuck with them? Are
your
we
Honor,
stuck with those findings?
Well, the second issue, your honors, that I'm not sure if Judge Hartman properly used the right standard. So it doesn't matter what finding of fact he used. He compared all of these cases that Mr. Collette had. He compared what the maximum possible penalty would have potentially been had Mr. Collette gone to trial. And then he basically said, you obviously got the benefit of the bargain of your plea. But that begs the question, in 99.9% of cases, then no ineffective assistance of counsel argument could withstand that, because that's the whole point of plea bargaining. The only way that I guess that would happen is if I pled someone guilty to habitual criminals counts or something of that nature. But other than that, of course, the plea bargain is going to be better than going to trial as far as the maximum possible penalty. That's the entire point of that. So the fact that Judge Hartman, the trial court, uses that standard of review for making his finding of prejudice, I don't know how that fits with Mr. Collette's finding of fact for whether he's credible or not, because I believe the trial court used the wrong standard anyway.
Thank you.
And I believe that I have 12 seconds, and so I will sit down, Your Honors. Thank you.
Proceed, counsel.
May it please the court, Karina Garrity, 34931, on behalf of the people of Colorado. This case essentially boils down to defense counsel doing everything possible under circumstances that were not ideal, and the defendant making a fully informed decision to move forward with a beneficial global disposition. Looking closely at the trial court's findings in this case with respect to the performance prong, the court found that this plea bargain was first difficult to achieve, that regarding the 8 cases pending against the defendant, the parties started with the possible sentence and then worked out the charges and the cases that would constitute the guilty plea later. This deal reduced the defendant's sentence exposure by over 50 years. Counsel halted the proceeding upon realizing the lack of discovery for this case. The defense reviewed the discovery for as long as necessary. Counsel discussed all possible concerns and defenses with the defendant. Counsel tried to renegotiate the plea, but the prosecutor refused to alter it. And the defendant elected to proceed aware of the situation and his options. And moreover, he affirmed that no additional time was needed. With respect to the date discrepancy, I think it's notable that the court didn't specifically find that the defendant raised the date discrepancy on the date of the Providency hearing. Counsel's testimony was that he couldn't remember specifically having that conversation with the defendant. He couldn't remember specifically if it was discussed. He seemed to vaguely recall, but he couldn't remember specifically, and the defendant's testimony, he admitted that March 20th was only on the PSI. So the court didn't find that defendant raised a date discrepancy at that time, but it did find that as to the official paperwork, the March 20th date appeared only on the PSI and was an obvious typo. And with respect to the charges, the plea agreement, the advisement, and everything that occurred at the Providency hearing, all of those things indicated that the crime occurred on March 2nd.
Excuse me, Ms. Garrity, you indicated that the defendant admitted that the date discrepancy was only on the PSIR. Where is that admission?
Specifically the page number.
Well, what part of the record is that admission in?
That's his testimony at the 35C hearing.
At the 35C hearing.
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
Thank you.
And his testimony was somewhat inconsistent because he kept insisting, no, I had raised this. But then later on, he admitted that the first time that he saw the March 20th date was on the PSI. So from these findings, the court made a correct conclusion of law, which was that counsel's actions were acceptable under the totality of the circumstances. The failure to review discovery earlier was an oversight. It wasn't an affirmative choice. And in response to this mistake, counsel remedied the situation before moving forward. And the standard is not that defense counsel can never make a mistake, or that mistakes can never be remedies, or that the situation always has to be ideal. Another way to look at this is, what else could counsel have done under these circumstances? And I don't think that counsel could reasonably be expected to demand a delay in the proceedings when the defendant himself is saying that he's ready to proceed. Or it wouldn't be reasonable for the defense counsel to conduct further investigation despite the defendant's decision to plead guilty. And in terms of the defendant's decision to plead guilty, he was in fact deemed competent. And regarding the advisement or advice of the length of the sentence, this is not an issue that has been pursued on appeal, and it's clearly contradicted by the record. In terms of prejudice, the trial court made a correct conclusion that the defendant did not demonstrate that if not for counsel's mistakes, he would have insisted on going to trial. Notwithstanding the fact that the trial court didn't believe the defendant's statement that he would have insisted on going to trial, this statement alone is insufficient to establish prejudice because it's subjective, self-serving, and retrospective. If this were the accepted standard, it would essentially render the prejudice prong meaningless. The only
thing, the defendant's statement that he would not have gone to trial, that's not sufficient.
That's correct. That there must be some kind of objective, corroborating evidence to support that statement. And here, the only hint at the corroboration presented was this possible alibi defense. But that defense wasn't even in existence at the time of the Providency hearing because it appeared only on the PSI. And it clearly wouldn't have been viable because, as you stated, the crime occurred on March 2nd and there wasn't any conflicting evidence with respect to that. And the defendant admitted that he wasn't in custody on that day. So the defendant would have taken the plea even if discovery and the investigation had proceeded in an ideal fashion. He received a substantial benefit from the plea bargain, and he ultimately proceeded with knowledge of all the relevant information. So the defendant has not met his burden to prove ineffective assistance of counsel, and this process can be relied upon as having produced a just result. So the people respectfully request this court to affirm the trial court's denial of post-conviction relief.
Thank you, counsel. And thank both counsel for your briefing.
Mr. Williams has 12 seconds if he wants.
Oh, that's right, you do. You have 12 seconds, Mr. Williams. Okay. Again, thank you for your arguments, and the matter will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course.